Good evening, everyone. Today's Dhamma talk, I hope to continue with the Four Noble Truths. We have been dealing with the first noble truth of dukkha sufficiently, I suppose, and also with the causes of dukkha yesterday, namely ignorance leading to different forms of craving. And today I would like to talk about the third noble truth, the end of dukkha. And that is quite a lofty subject. The end of dukkha is actually what we're really looking for. The end of dukkha is also called nirvana, and it makes it a little difficult because nirvana is something that cannot really be conceptualized. So it's also difficult to talk about, but one can try to make an attempt to sort of approximate it, perhaps, in describing what nirvana is supposed to be. The very word nirvana consists of nir and vana, and nir is a kind of negative, a negative of vana, and vana meaning a type of becoming. So nirvana would be non-becoming. Now that is already quite difficult to visualize, and the Buddha probably used purposely some terms that are trying to avoid to make any picture in your mind or otherwise of that goal, which is called nirvana, non-becoming. Sometimes it is called the extinction of greed, hatred, and delusion. That would be a kind of psychological definition of nirvana, where the person who realizes it is free from greed, hatred, and delusion. And what we already saw in the case of the causes of suffering, that delusion seems to be the main culprit, the cause for greed and hatred and its different forms, shows that this overcoming of delusion is in a way the reaching of nirvana. So if we can overcome delusion by developing wisdom, which we already mentioned, you know, to overcome delusion we have to develop different levels of wisdom, the wisdom of hearing and reading about it, then the thinking and discussing about it, and then the realization for oneself. In the first place of the things as they really are, and that is the conditioned things that have to do with our sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thought. Everything under the sun also, all the physical things are conditioned, and if we can see those as they are, then we have right view in a way. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, right view is equal to nirvana, but it can help us to attain nirvana. Another kind of definition of nirvana is non-becoming. When becoming comes to an end or to a halt, bhava nirodho nibbanam. Nibbanam is nirvana. Bhava is that process of becoming. Nirodha is coming to a halt. So when bhava comes to a halt, then nirvana is. That's yet another way of expressing it. And sometimes the Buddha used positive words to describe nirvana, such as the highest happiness, paramang sukhang, what I also use in this blessing chant at the end of the meditation usually. So that is a kind of epithet of nirvana, another word for nirvana, a description of it. Paramang sukhang, the highest happiness, and also the deepest peace. Parama shanti. Shanti, you may have heard, peace. Parama shanti is the greatest peace or the deepest peace. And then the greatest security, usually is the way I translate it, and that is coming actually in that verse which I chant in Pali, Sada Sotti. Sada means eternal, Sotti means security. So a kind of eternal security. Now what else do you really want than the highest happiness, the deepest peace and greatest security, one could wonder. So once you would have that, the other kind of cravings may become less or not so significant anymore. And another thing that the Buddha mentioned about nirvana is that it is, the highest achievement of human evolution in a way, or of any being to attain that nirvana. There's nothing really beyond that. It is a freedom from suffering and at the same time a realization of something that is so solid and so real to the person who realizes it. But to a person who hasn't yet realized it, it's just a word. Now, the problem with nirvana in one sense is that since it is not made up of any kind of substance, you cannot sort of touch it or hear it or smell it or see it. What has to be realized, they say, by one's mind, but not by the thinking mind, because you cannot think out nirvana. Whatever description you might give of it is sort of missing the point, although these are all, the other descriptions are pointers towards it. So it has to be something that can be realized by one's mind, but not by the thinking mind, not just by hoping it or aspiring for it only, but by some process where one realizes it for oneself. And then apparently the person who realizes that is beyond doubt. And that nirvana is something which we say is the third noble truth. So it also has another connotation in the sense of no more rebirth after this, once one has attained nirvana. But I should say that there are two stages of nirvana. Like the Buddha himself attained or realized nirvana at the age of 35, after 6 years of ascetic practices. You know, he left the palace at the age of 29, went off to meet the best yoga and meditation masters of his time, and finally sat down under the ficus religiosa, the Bodhi tree, which is later on called the Bodhi tree after his enlightenment, the tree under which the Buddha attained Bodhi or enlightenment. So that was at the age of 35. He realized nirvana, but he was still continuing to live. He actually became more alive, you could say, more active, and he went all over the place, especially the northern Indian Gangetic plains, the river Ganga or Ganges, and the area in that northern part of India. Especially he was very active for 45 years, and then he attained at his demise or his death a stage which is called parinibbana or parinirvana. That is, the difference is that at the age of 35, when he attained nirvana, it is called the nirvana with a substratum remaining. That means the body and mind of that being still is there. And at the final passing away, it is called no substratum remaining nirvana. One in Pali is saupadisesa nibbanam, and the one at the end of the life of an enlightened being is nirupadisesa nibbanam. So that is the difference. And another thing is that nirvana is not some kind of heaven or a place where we can go to. Sometimes it is depicted like that, but it is not a kind of heaven or an abode or a geographical place where you can go to, or a heavenly world where you can be reborn. There are some schools within Buddhism, for instance, what is called the Pure Land School of Buddhism, where the practitioners aspire to be born in the Pure Land or the Western Paradise or the realm where the Amitabha Buddha is residing. And that is purely, I would say, a Mahayana concept or a Mahayana teaching, which we do not find in the Theravada Buddhism. It is probably a later development of Buddhism, where the Buddha of infinite light, which is a direct translation of the word Amitabha Buddha, is supposed to reside. But he is not a human being who has attained nirvana like the historical Buddha, but he is supposed to be a type of an eternal being in a very pure heavenly realm. We call it Sukhavati, the happy realm. And so when people aspire to be born there, they hope to live more or less forever and be with the Amitabha Buddha in that kind of realm. But that kind of practice you don't find really in the oldest form of Buddhism, which we call Theravada Buddhism. So perhaps it is something that makes things a little bit easier, a kind of worshipping and an aspiring to be reborn in that realm. And a repetition of the name of Amitabha is one of the practices. And then also not to forget the good karma that we do, and then hoping by the good karma and your repetition of his name and the aspiration to be born in that realm, that perhaps your stream of consciousness stays there for a very, very, very long time. It would be like a rebirth in Devaloka, according to our kind of calculation. But it is not what we would say a final solution to the problem of conditioned existence. So it is not to be confused, you know, to attain that kind of heavenly rebirth and live there for, maybe not forever, I would say. It's probably for a very long time. And if there's any karma left over, one would be coming down to another realm to receive the results of those previous actions. And the Buddha also said that as there is nirvana, there is an escape from this round of rebirths. If there would be no nirvana, then there would be no way out of rebirth. If everything is based on cause and effect, like karma and its results, then it would go on and on and on and on and on and on without end. But because there is such a thing as the unconditioned, that's another description of nirvana, or the deathless, the birthless, the unconditioned, all different terms for that one nirvana. Since there is that unconditioned, one can realize it and get out of the conditioned. But that is like a sort of qualitative leap in a way. It's not that you can get to the unconditioned through the conditionings only. There has to be some sort of letting go of those conditionings by realizing their relative importance, perhaps. So the third noble truth is, in a way, the hopeful aspect of the four noble truths. The first sound a little bit like, are you, you know, all this suffering and frustration and conflict, dukkha, from birth to death, it's never satisfactory. And then, we do have these internal factors of craving and ignorance, and how to overcome them. Of course, the Buddha showed the path, and we can do that by our own efforts, in a way, by applying the right effort, the right mindfulness, and the right concentration, with the right view also coming in. Then you may be able to overcome that. And then the fact that there is such a thing that as nirvana, that is the hopeful aspect. But then, where is that nirvana, one could ask? If it's not in some heavenly abode, then where is it? And the Buddha pointed out that it is basically to be found within yourself. It is something that you cannot go to. It's not a rebirth. It's not another place or in the distant future, but something that can be discovered or uncovered, you could call it, within yourself. And this is part of our practice also, and I hope to talk about it tomorrow morning when we have the third talk on the techniques of meditation. The discovery or the uncovering of that state of pure bliss and security, the nirvana. So in the mind there must be something that is unconditioned. There is a conditioned part, like your thoughts and your emotions and everything that has to do with the senses, but then there must be something unconditioned to be discovered within this. You don't need to really go anywhere. So there we cannot go really by thinking it out and hoping and plotting and calculating, but somehow or other by discovering it, maybe by letting go of the negativities, for one thing. The Buddha has said one thing about our mind, that it is shining by its own nature. Pabhasara citta is a kind of shining mind, which is the real nature of your mind. And the impurities, they are called kileshas, such as greed and hatred, jealousy and such things, are just like sort of uninvited guests. They come and go. And they are the conditionings of that part of your mind, which we call the conditioned. And they probably come from causes and effects in the past, and they continue as long as there is ignorance, but they don't have to always continue like that. So that also may be interesting, to combine this with a little reflection on karma. Karma, and also with that rebirth goes along with it. Now, karma sometimes is seen as a kind of fate. This is my karma. And usually with a long face, you know, because it's seen as something bad. But people forget that there's good karma as well as bad karma. There's skillful karma as well as unskillful karma. And it is not some sort of a lawmaker who keeps track of our deeds in the golden book of deeds, but it is something that is sort of stored in our own stream of consciousness, it seems. As you look as a human being, as a physical body and a mind, and the mind having this stream of consciousness, which comes actually from previous lives, according to the Buddha's teachings. It's not that, you know, we start with this birth and this is the only birth and it ends with death, but there is something before this, another life, not in the same body, but with the stream of consciousness which came from somewhere, looking for another rebirth. And if there is still karma left over and no realization of nirvana at the end of this life, then it will also continue looking for a suitable place to be reborn, either in a human realm, human womb, or in an animal if it has those tendencies, or in a higher or lower plane of existence, higher in the sense more subtle peace and happiness, and in a lower realm more suffering. So, as I mentioned before, the human realm is really considered to be the most ideal realm, although it always is a combination of and a mixture of happiness and unhappiness, and you know, gain and loss, and fame and blame, and such pairs of opposites are all things that everybody goes through. And it is seen as that is partly the result of your own previous karma, your own deeds, basically. Now, not every deed is a karmic deed. That is what we have to understand about karma. Karma means that kind of action which goes together with a volition, an intention. The Buddha said it like this, Cetanaham bhikkave kammang vadami. It is the cetana, which means volition, which creates the karma, which determines whether the karma is good or bad, or skillful or unskillful. So when we talk about unskillful or bad karma, then we talk about thoughts, words and deeds which are based on unskillful roots, meaning greed, hatred, jealousy and things like that, basically based on ignorance. In the different forms it expresses itself, and that leads to a ripple effect where you get the result of your own actions either immediately in that present life or in the immediately following life or in any future life. That is, they say, depending on the type of karma and the moment that you are intending this within the moment of consciousness, is very complicated. In the Abhidhamma they have a whole list of enumerations about it, but it becomes a little bit too much maybe just to talk about it now in that kind of detail. But anyway, different types of karma, heavy karma, light karma, medium karma, good and bad, skillful and unskillful, leads to the good results and the bad results of your own actions. Basically, we say that you are the creator of your own karma and you are the inheritor or the heir to your own karma. So nobody else can really do it for you, or nobody else can inherit it for you, from you. So we have to sort of go through that karma, but it is not an unchanged or a fixed or a predetermined fate, which some people might think. Although there's something to be discussed about that, how free are we in our choices, that is yet another thing. But we tend to believe that we are free to choose this or to do that, or to not to do something, or to do it in a different way. And that depends on our own maybe willpower, on our so-called free will, and on various factors. Maybe also depending on previous karma, what kind of choices we make. But still, with willpower and discrimination between good and bad, we may be able to change that so-called fate. And therefore, the Buddha also has given utterances like, you are not a Brahmin just because you are born a Brahmin, or you're not untouchable because you were born an untouchable. but you can change your status. You can move up what is called the vertical mobility within the society. It's not that, you know, the caste system is completely kind of fixed forever, but it depends on your own thoughts, words, and deeds, how pure you are. So with karma, it is a bit complicated, because there are so many hundreds of thousands, maybe, of previous lives, and so many zillions of karmic formations which have gone before this, and one leading to another, and one result becoming a cause of yet another, and not only one, but a number of causes leading to a certain situation, that if something major happens to us, we can't quite understand where it comes from. I haven't done anything in this lifetime to deserve that, for instance, but, you know, it could come from some previous karma. Only thing is that we don't even remember what we had for lunch on the 13th of December, so let alone what we did in a previous life. That is something that we don't really usually remember. But some people do remember certain fragments of their previous lives, but not everything. So it says maybe only a fully enlightened being could see in one glance all these factors, but that is the way that it is described. But for a normal worldling, it is impossible to really understand fully the workings of karma. It is unthinkable, an achinteya, it's called. You cannot fathom it with your logical and limited linear mind. So sometimes people, when they say, well, this must be my karma, and if you really accept it, you can be happy, rather than trying to find out why did it happen to me, and why not to another, and so on. Couldn't it have been different, and all those kind of questions, which don't really lead to your edification or your freedom from doubts and so on. So not that it really shows you exactly what is the cause or the causes of that particular situation, but if you cannot figure out where it comes from in this lifetime, then it may be something to do with previous karma. And another thing is regarding karma and nirvana, what I said, if it is only karma and cause and effect that determines everything, then there would be no way out. So that fact that the unconditioned, the unborn, the undying element can be realized through the realization, yeah, basically in your mind, not as a concept or an idea, but as a reality, well, in that case, you know, there are certain types of karma which cannot be counteracted. There are other types of karma, what is called light karma, can be made inoperative by doing something good. For instance, if you have a slightly bad deed, can be overcome by a good deed, balanced out and made inoperative. But some very, very heavy karma can never be counteracted and sort of balanced out and made inoperative. So they say certain types of karma have to be experienced in their results, bad results of very bad heavy karma, such as what is called matricide or patricide, the killing of your own mother or your father. And also, according to the Buddhists, the wounding of a Buddha, or the splitting of the Sangha, and the drawing of blood of an enlightened being. So those are kind of things which are really considered to be so bad that they cannot be just overcome by other kind of good karma. Now, there is an example of a disciple of the Buddha called Moggallana, who was already an enlightened being as a follower of the Buddha. He had realized nirvana, and there was not going to be any more rebirth after this, but yet he experienced a terrible death. Namely, he was clubbed to death by, they say, 500 robbers. And you would normally sort of expect somebody to at least try to fight back or to get angry or hate those people or do something about it. But Moggallana suddenly realized that this was a result of one of those very heavy karmas. Namely, he realized he had killed his own mother in a long, long distant past life. And he had to undergo this particular fate, you could call it in this way. And he didn't do anything about it, and he actually died in that terrible way. So, but he did not create any fresh, bad, unskillful karma which would result in another kind of rebirth. So that is to show that sometimes certain types of karma have to be repaid and other types of karma can be sort of forgiven or forgotten or not becoming operative again. Don't know whether it makes sense what I'm talking, or am I just babbling on and talking to the walls, or reality check? Okay. So, the third noble truth, I think we have fairly covered what it means, isn't it? Nirvana. So, another thing is that the realization of Nirvana is said, according to Buddhist teachings, that it cannot be achieved just by the practice of Samatha Bhavana or tranquility meditation. That is what the Buddha actually discovered before his enlightenment. He had learned from his teachers, his yogic teachers, techniques to really get deep into the tranquility meditation and to reach what is called all the eight dhyanas, the levels of form and formless spheres up to the highest level, and that is called the Ashtasamapatti, where you can sit for a whole week without moving, without drinking, without eating, and needing anything, and not even hear if 500 bullock carts are passing by. You wouldn't move, or you wouldn't be able to hear it. Such absorption. But then the Prince Siddhartha, who was in his process of enlightenment, realized that that kind of deep jhanic meditation is still a kind of conditioned mind, not a freedom from the conditionings, but rather a suppression of the thoughts, concentration on a particular object, excluding other things, and getting peace of mind in that way. But as Krishnamurti said, he may have only then realized a peace of the mind and not real peace of mind, if you see the difference. So that tranquility meditation has its function, but it is not the end of all types of meditation, because it doesn't get you out of the cycle of rebirth. When you get out of it, you may be getting back to square one, so to speak. No spiritual progress in that sense. Maybe psychic powers, if you call that spiritual, some people call it that's material, and not really spiritual progress to the liberation from the causes of suffering. So if you want that, then you would have to somehow or other realize these things through mindfulness, awareness, through insight. And that's why we practice this insight meditation. So in that sense, we see it as a higher form of meditation, namely that it can take you out of that suffering, out of conflict, out of the cycle of rebirth eventually. And if not in this lifetime, then maybe in the next, or in the next. You cannot be in a real hurry also to achieve it. Sometimes the more you hurry, the slower you go. Like, I want to have patience, but I want to have it now, kind of thing. But working on it is not a bad thing. And not to forget about the good karma in the meantime, just in case if we don't attain nirvana in this lifetime, it's always good to have a storeroom full of good karma to rely on in your future lives. So, karma and rebirth are interrelated, as I said, and I already mentioned a couple of times, but maybe just to enumerate them once again, the different levels of rebirth according to the Buddhist cosmology, as it is seen, you know, the different levels of existence or the different realms, as they are called, or worlds. Generally speaking, they say there are six realms, namely the human realm, the animal realm, the Deva realm, the Brahma realm, and the unhappy spirits called Beta realm, and Narakadi, or the hellish realms. So these are forms of existence, maybe not so much like a physical location, you know, like you go up and down the ladder and then you go to hell, or you go to heaven and you reside there, but more like the amount of happiness that a being experiences in a finer material sphere, or the amount of unhappiness that a being experiences as a result of bad karma. For instance, what they call the hungry ghosts realm, that is the Beta realm, those are beings who are always hungry but never can get enough food. They're depicted with a very narrow sort of throat, a long narrow throat, and a bloated belly, and, you know, never being able to satisfy themselves. Those are depictions. Maybe it looks quite different when you really get there, but we have to wait and see. And I haven't talked to anybody who has really come back from those realms, so it's a little bit hard to verify. But anyway, that there is a continuation of the stream of consciousness as long as there is becoming, and as long as there's this ignorance and craving, one can imagine that there is a kind of becoming in some form or other. And this human realm, of course, consisting of the body and the mind, the body is purely physical, but the mind, well, what is it and where is it? You know, like this Zen master asking the pupil, go and look for your mind. And the pupil comes back after a week, I can't find it. Oh, you've got it. That kind of thing. Well, where is the mind? It's some people point here, you know, the seat of consciousness near the heart. Some people may be pointing here or here or here. Or maybe it's something around the body. That could also be. Some, what you call pure materialists, might say, there's no mind without a brain, and the brain is equal to the mind, and when the brain starts developing, only then the mind develops, and then with the, you know, the clinical death or the brain death of a being, then that mind is completely gone. But if you wonder, you know, how is it possible then for people to have, for instance, out-of-the-body experiences, or in the case of near-death experiences, that they look down upon their own body from a distance and see how the doctor is already signing the death certificate and things like that, and zap, they come back into their body and continue to live, for instance. Or if the brain were the only storehouse for all the memories, then how is it possible for a person to recollect previous lives, for instance. Now, the very skeptical persons might say, well, there's another way, you know, they can tap into somebody else's mind and read minds and then remember actually not their own but somebody else's. But that goes a little bit too far according to me. But I believe that there is a continuation of the stream of consciousness, as we call it, that mind after death, and that stream of consciousness will look for a suitable place to sort of enact all those karmic forces from previous lives. I don't know if it would be too much to cover yet another couple of things, since we don't have so many evenings. You know, with the factors of cause and effect, like karma, the Buddha has said that it is not only karma which is operative, that it is not only karma which determines everything that happens, but there are, according to his description, five types of laws of cause and effect operating. And I'll just enumerate them and then go into them little by little. One is called the law of the seed. Like, maybe you could call it genes, or genetic inheritance, or biological inheritance from your grandparents, your parents, what you have body-wise. And that would be called the law of the seed. In the trees and in the animal world also, you find that usually if you have an apple seed and you plant it, and of course you have to give it water, there has to be soil, there has to be sunshine, etc., that, you know, you don't get a banana tree from an apple seed usually. The seed that is planted will resemble the tree, or the tree will resemble the seed that is planted. Unless, of course, a miracle happens, but that is very rare. So these laws of cause and effect can be in that field also. And then there is the law of what is called the environment or the climate. The climate is called Uttu Niyama. Niyama actually means law of cause and effect. Uttu would be kind of climate or environment. So, for instance, the climate in which you grow up determines part of your life. Whether you're growing up in a hot climate, a cold climate, dry or, you know, wet climate, and not only a physical climate, but also an economic, social climate, or a political climate. All those things, also the peer groups, your teachers, your friends, all that determines your life, not only karma. Some people say, well, the fact that you're born into a certain family and have that genetic makeup also is your karma. But Buddha said, no, there are some other factors which may be operating just by themselves. So you have this Bija Niyama, this law of the seed, the law of the environment or the climate. Then you have the Karma Niyama. And then we have what is called the Chitta Niyama, the mind itself. The fact that as a human being we have the possibility to choose to do something or not to do something, or to do it in a different way. The willpower, the discrimination between good and bad and all that kind of thing. As a human being we do have that Chitta Niyama also, which can steer your path in your life. It's not only determined just by karma. And then there is the fifth one, that would be the Dhamma Niyama, the law of nature, the natural causes, such as, for instance, the sun and the moon and the stars that determine quite a lot of our life. If you look at astrology, maybe some people don't believe in astrology, but astrology is considered to be a science. Not that everybody who practices it, especially for money, is a real knowledgeable astrologer, but still, the influence of the stars and the moon and the the planets also determines a lot of how your life is going to be. And other kind of things like the sun, as already mentioned, radiation from the sun and other kind of things, gravity and so many things that come from the law of nature, or natural disasters, for instance, that could happen, that determine part of your life. Now, to be caught in a tsunami or in a cyclone or in a hurricane or something like that may have something to do with your karma, but it is not absolutely necessarily always true. There may be an exception to the rule, you could say, also. So these different factors are rather complex, but I thought for completion or being complete sake, we should also mention them. Of course, it's much easier to believe that it's only karma, and this is my karma, and that's it, and then be satisfied. But since the other things are there, we might as well mention them, but it makes it rather very complex. But then the thing is that whatever it is, and whatever those factors may be, we might not be able to understand all of them or really know all of them, but we do know, or you can know, what is happening to you from moment to moment, I suppose. The other things about past and future may be more in the realm of speculation, in a way. But what happens to us from moment to moment, what kind of things we meet, people, situations, sounds and sights, etc., that is something that we do know. And then how you react to that in the moment, from moment to moment, also is something that is happening in the present. So that is why it's so important to practice something in the present moment, and that is really the only time that we can do something about anything. You cannot really do anything in the past, that's already gone, and you cannot do anything yet in the future. The future will become the present. If you wait long enough, the future will become the present. But you have to do, or you can do something only, really speaking, in the present. So if that present is looked after well by your right view, your right action, your right speech, your right livelihood, your right awareness, your mindfulness and your concentration, then you are what is called completing the Eightfold Path also, and you are doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. There's just this funny story, maybe to end on a lighter note, of these two Boy Scouts who were trying to do a good deed every day, and then in the evening they would compare notes and meet each other and said, "Hey, what have you done today, you know, for a good deed?" So this boy says, "Oh, you know, I've done a very good thing." "Oh, what did you do?" "Well, I helped an old lady to cross the street." "Ah, very good, very good." He said, "You know, but it took me 45 minutes. Then the other guy asks, "Why did it take you so long?" Then he says, "She didn't really want to cross the street." So if you're trying to do a good deed, be aware that you do it in the right way, at the right moment, to the right person.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.